Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
You're listening to the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Oliver Conway. This edition is published in the early hours of Monday, the 24th of July. The Conservative People's Party in Spain has claimed victory in the general election, but it may not be able to form a government after its far-right allies Vox did badly. More protests and last-ditch talks in Israel ahead of a parliamentary vote on controversial plans to curb the power of the courts. And the US TV weatherman who quit his job after receiving death threats for reporting on climate change. Also in the podcast, no let-up in the fighting in Sudan 100 days after the conflict began. And later...
Bonde, you're a superhero. I'm telling Boma and Bondate.
Netflix releases its first ever original African animation series. Will the far right enter government in Spain for the first time since the Franco dictatorship ended nearly half a century ago? Well, that had seemed eminently possible before Sunday's election. But with the results in, it is looking a lot less likely. As expected, the Conservative Popular Party won the largest number of seats, to the delight of its supporters. But the party's far-right allies Vox did badly, losing a third of their seats. And so the right-wing bloc overall is short of a majority. Nevertheless, the popular party leader, Alberto Núñez Feijóo, says he will try to form a government. But he has fewer natural allies than the current socialist Prime Minister Pedro Sánchez, whose party did better than expected. So what should we make of it all? Sergei Forcada Freixas is our correspondent in Madrid.
Tonight we have a winner, the Popular Party, but it's a bittersweet win for them because even if you add the MPs from far-right Vox, they fall short from a majority, and that was their goal, trying to reach a government either in a coalition with the far-right Vox or either with support in parliament. So even by winning, they may still be in opposition. But that's not a victory either for Pedro Sánchez, the incumbent prime minister, the socialist leader Pedro Sánchez, may also fall short from a majority. So in the end, we may not have even a winner or even a prime minister for weeks. The most scenario that may end up happening is actually going for new elections.
Why did Vox do so badly? They lost quite a lot of seats.
It's actually that maybe they peaked their ceiling in the 2019 elections when they got over 50 seats. They only got 10 seats before the 2019 elections. I think that what happened is that those who had voted Vox in the past wanted Núñez Feijóo to be the president, the next Spanish prime minister and oust socialist leader Pedro Sánchez. So I think that Núñez Feijóo managed to capitalize part of the vote from Vox. And also, to be fair, during the debates, Santiago Abascal is the Vox leader, so he didn't manage to put his message out in a clear way.
Nevertheless, the Conservative leader, Núñez Feijóo, will get the first chance at forming a government. Could he perhaps persuade some of those smaller parties to join the Popular Party and Vox and enter government?
It's very difficult because the problem for those minority parties, like, for example, looking at the Basque parties, for example, or some parties from the Canary Islands, they may be okay with the Conservatives. The problem is here. They don't want to have anything to do with Vox. So that's the problem. If the Conservatives need Vox, then they can't really have anyone else. And with the results that we got in these elections, that's Núñez Feijóo's problems. He can't rely on Vox plus other parties. So that's why this is a bittersweet victory for the Conservative candidate.
Sergei Forcada Freixas in Madrid. Almost every weekend this year in Israel, thousands of people have taken to the streets over government plans to curb the power of the courts. As Parliament debated the first of those proposals on Sunday, thousands of protesters gathered in Jerusalem. Well, as the standoff in Israeli society approaches a possible climax, the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is in hospital after having a pacemaker fitted in an emergency operation overnight. He says he is doing well and expects to be discharged in time for the vote in Parliament on Monday. Nevertheless, the Israeli President, Isaac Herzog, visited him in hospital on Sunday for last-ditch talks. I asked our Middle East editor, Sebastian Usher, exactly what the two men might have been discussing.
I think this is another effort by President Herzog to try to reach some kind of consensus about this overhaul. He led efforts to try and get talks between the government, the opposition, over several months, which haven't really gone anywhere. So this is very much a last-ditch effort. President Herzog was actually in the US most of this past week. He's just arrived back, so he rushed to the hospital where the Prime Minister is being treated and seems to be in pretty good shape. Nothing has come out of the meeting, but before he went in, President Herzog described the situation, Israel, as an emergency and saying that agreement must be reached. He also, President Herzog, will be meeting leaders of the opposition later this evening too, Yair Lapid, who was the previous Prime Minister, and Benny Gantz. So obviously he's trying to do some last-ditch mediation ahead of a vote that's due to take place on Monday.
They've been debating this in the Knesset. What is expected to happen in that vote?
The coalition that Benjamin Netanyahu finally managed to get together in the last election is bigger than the ones he's had before, and at the moment it's expected to hold. So there's a second and third reading of the bill with the votes on them. That's meant to happen on Monday and to be over by this time tomorrow. So if the process isn't stopped, if that doesn't happen, yes, this vote will go through. This is, remember, though, only the first part of this agenda that Mr. Netanyahu's current government, which is the most far right in Israel's history, is intending to push through over the coming months.
Our Middle East regional editor, Sebastian Usher. The Greek authorities are carrying out more evacuations on the island of Rhodes as firefighters battle three wildfires there. Earth-moving machines were brought in to create firewalls to try to prevent the blazes reaching densely forested areas. Thousands of people have already reached safety, including these British tourists.
We were told by the police to evacuate. We went and packed a bag. When we came back, fire was halfway down the hill and we were keen to get on the bus and get away. It was a dangerous situation and there was people that were fleeing with just a few belongings, and as they were leaving the hotel, the oil tank blew up and the hotel was flattened, basically.
Packing my stuff in my room because I'm not believing this. Then the alarm out. Where I stayed is a hotel for 800 people. There wasn't enough coaches to move 800 people, but the fire was coming. I walked 12 miles in this heat yesterday. It took me 4 hours, along with 700 or 800 other people.
It is horrendous. Never been so scared my entire life. Terrifying experience.
Well, emergency services are also dealing with fires in other parts of Greece, including on Corfu, where residents of a number of settlements have been told to leave. Greece, like much of southern Europe, is in the midst of an intense heatwave. Julian Marshall managed to speak to Olga Kefaloyanni, Greece's tourism minister, who's currently in Rhodes.
It's been a tough 72 hours. I myself just arrived in the island of Rhodes. Only a small part of the island has actually been affected by the wildfires. Still, this required for a mass evacuation, and we had actually one of the largest operations ever. 16,000 were transported by land and 3,000 by sea. It's actually important to stress that the airport has been functioning as normal. We never had a disruption with flights. So our main concern is the safety of locals, safety of our visitors, and also to provide the necessary accommodation to all our visitors who were evacuated from the hotels.
And have you been briefed at all on the extent of the destruction caused by these wildfires? Because, of course, not just tourists affected, but also local residents.
The truth is that the part of the island that was affected was mainly the part with a lot of hotels, also some of the locals. But it's also important to stress that locals have been very, very helpful. We have a lot of volunteers. Of course, you understand that it was almost impossible to find 20,000 hotel rooms on an island which is operating on high season. And of course, it's one of the most attractive destinations, maybe the most attractive destination in Greece. So we needed to temporarily house the evacuees in hotels, but also in conference halls, in sports centers, in schools.
Are the firefighters still struggling to contain the fires? Are they getting foreign assistance?
We do have foreign assistance, but this is a part of a system that exists. So there's a solidarity between countries. Of course, when it comes to the wildfire, we remain very vigilant. Our brave firemen have been working around the clock to ensure that the fire doesn't get out of control.
Minister, how do you counteract, though, the obviously very negative publicity this is going to generate around the world, images of tourists having to flee their hotels because of wildfires?
Look, it's important to stress again, as I said, that this is only in a small area of the whole island. Everything else is operating as normal, and it's very important that everybody was safely evacuated.
Olga Kefaloyani on Rhodes, talking to Julian Marshall. Pope Francis, meanwhile, has waded into the debate about extreme weather. In his weekly address in St. Peter's Square, he called for leaders to take urgent action to combat climate change.
We are experiencing here and in many countries extreme climatic events. Various regions are affected by abnormal heat waves and devastating fires. On the other, in many places, there are rainstorms and floods. I renew my appeal to the leaders of nations to do something more concrete to limit polluting emissions. It is an urgent challenge and cannot be put off. It concerns everyone.
One of the countries experiencing record-breaking temperatures at the moment is the US. Chris Gloninger is a meteorologist in the state of Iowa, but he's had to give up his job as a local TV weatherman after receiving death threats for linking extreme weather events to climate change in his reports. He's been talking to Audrey Brown.
Ever since I was a child, I was interested in the weather when Hurricane Bob hit my hometown back in 1991. And that passion just grew over time. And I stayed in broadcast for that 18-year span of time. And prior to Iowa, I made it to Boston, which in the United States is a top 10 television market. It's where I started the country's first weekly series on climate change. That recognition that I received from developing that series landed me the job in Iowa as chief meteorologist. The station in Iowa wanted to fill a void because no one was really talking about climate change and connecting the dots between extreme weather and what was happening with our changing climate. I was there a total of 2 years before I decided to move on following the death threat and obsessive emails that I received.
What happened? Because if you've been a meteorologist, was this the first time you'd spoken about it?
Audrey, no, it wasn't. In Boston, even I received pushback in talking about climate change. But in Iowa, it was instant. I started hearing criticism. And to me, that was strange because the GDP in Iowa is largely based on agriculture, makes up 11% of the total GDP of the state. And wind power makes up 65% of the electric grid. So the costs for energy are incredibly low, and these wind turbines are supplementing farmers' income. So the pushback I received confused me. Last summer, I received a death threat and then harassing emails from the same individual for a couple of weeks until police made contact with him. He pled guilty to harassment in the third degree, paid a $105 fine, but that really wasn't enough. And it ended up in my going to therapy for about a year to try to figure out what would happen next for me and my wife as we move forward.
You had been in this job for how long?
I had been in the job for a year before I received the death threat, but I'd say the year before the death threat, there was pushback by people not liking that I was talking about climate change. They thought I was bringing politics into my weathercast. You hear the common misinformation that the climate's always been changing. How can humans be responsible for it? They blame anything else but humans. And I tried to explain that climate scientists have spent their careers figuring out every other possibility other than anthropogenic causes, but everything goes back to us and burning fossil fuels.
Chris Gloninger, a meteorologist in the U.S. state of Iowa. Politicians around the world are becoming increasingly worried about deep fakes, videos of them saying or doing things they haven't actually done. The footage can be extremely convincing, and it takes time to work out what is real and what is fake. The technology firm Intel now claims to have the world's first real-time fake detection system. It's called Fake Catcher, and the BBC's North America technology reporter James Clayton has tried it out.
These days, it's not totally clear what's fake and what's not. Like this online video of President Zelensky telling Ukrainians to put down their arms and surrender to Russia. It was fake, but as AI developments make deepfakes easier to make and more convincing, detecting them has become more and more important. It's a problem that Intel claims to have solved by detecting blood under the skin. Their new system is called Fake Catcher, claiming to give real-time answers to whether a video is genuine or not.
We ask the question, what makes us humans? The answer is in our blood.
This is Ilkir Demir, senior research scientist at Intel Labs, in an advert for the system.
When your heart pumps blood, our veins are changing color, and that color change is called photoplethysmography, PPG for short. We take those PPG signals from many places on your face and convert them into PPG maps, and then we develop deep learning approach on top of that to classify into fake or real videos.
In essence, the system is looking for tiny signs of blood pumping below your skin, something deepfakes wouldn't have. Intel claims the system is 96% accurate and can work on all kinds of deepfakes. So we decided to test it out ourselves with Ilke at Intel's offices in Silicon Valley. We got a number of deepfakes and real videos of Donald Trump and Joe Biden, and then we put them through the system one by one.
Liability protections for companies are more important than individual financial relief for teachers or sanitation workers.
So in the beginning, when it sees like very little, it may say that, okay, is this a PPG? It looks real. And then it accumulates and finds it with, at the end, 84% accuracy fake.
That was correct.
Today, as the sitting president in the White House, I still believe that marriage should be between a man and a woman.
I'm a traditionalist, okay? Really?
Fake with 66% accuracy.
This is fake.
Yay. But it took time for it to get, because I think the overall face resolution is low in this one too. So I think that is also affecting that.
The system was good at finding fakes, but not so good at working out that a video was real, kind of important.
I'd be working with the leaders of Congress now.
I think fake.
That is actually real.
Really? So that means like the PPG signals are broken at some point. So, okay.
Here's a problem with the system. It doesn't analyze for audio yet, so often videos that seemed fairly obviously real were still labeled as fake. Matt Groh at MIT thinks the tech is interesting, but wants more information around its effectiveness.
I would want to see a lot of testing done by third parties to audit the effectiveness and accuracy of these algorithms. I don't doubt the stats that they listed in their initial evaluation. But what I do doubt is whether these stats are relevant to real-world context.
Deepfakes are going to become more and more of a problem. Perhaps Fake Catcher will be part of the mix of tools people use to catch them. But it's still by no means the finished article.
Our technology correspondent, James Clayton. Still to come on the Global News podcast. Meet Two Set Violin, the Australian musical comedy duo propelled to global fame via YouTube. A senior Indian official has arrived in the northeastern state of Manipur to offer support to women and girls affected by the ethnic violence there. Swati Maliwal, head of the Delhi Women's Commission, appealed to the state government to support her mission. The BJP Hindu nationalist authorities there and in Delhi have been accused of downplaying the persecution of the Kuki Christian minority, by the Meitei Hindu majority in the state. More than 160 people have died since the violence broke out on the 3rd of May. But the Indian Prime Minister only spoke out after a video emerged last week of two Kuki women being paraded naked by a Meitei mob before allegedly being gang-raped. Our correspondent Divya Arya reports from Manipur.
Shops are shut in this part of Manipur's capital city, Imphal, because another violent incident was reported here. Mostly residents in this area are staying indoors, stepping out only if they need some essentials. Now, what really strikes you when you come to Manipur is that the city and the state has seen no internet for more than 2.5 months now. It is really hard to communicate and resume normal life. And despite the fact that there is no internet, when we traveled around the state, we found that the video that shows two women being disrobed, paraded naked and then sexually assaulted was still being shared widely, and people would just take out their phones and show that video to us. It has fueled more anger, despair and discontent amongst both communities. Thousands are still displaced and in relief camps, unable to go back to their homes after they were set on fire in the violence that happened in the month of May. While there have been arrests after the video came out and there has been condemnation from both communities, especially spearheaded by women, everybody has been pointing out that the state government and the central government hasn't done enough, that the Prime Minister has spoken, but spoken too little and too late. Until there is a concerted effort to find a political resolution to the dispute, sporadic incidents of violence can continue. We've heard of reports of firing across the border overnight. Curfew is clamped every evening, and it will be very difficult for people to go back from relief camps and even think of rebuilding their lives.
Divya Arya in the northeastern Indian state of Manipur. As well as Spain, there was another election on Sunday, this time in Cambodia. But unlike in Spain, the outcome was known well before a single vote was cast. Longtime Cambodian leader Hun Sen was always going to win, having destroyed all opposition. But after nearly four decades in charge, the 70-year-old is now turning his attention to handing over power to his 45-year-old son, Hun Manet. Our Southeast Asia correspondent Jonathan Head spoke to the BBC's Julian Marshall from the Cambodian capital, Phnom Penh.
Cambodians know how Hun Sen plays it. He's an amazing survivor. He plays roughhouse politics. He's pretty thuggish. He has outmaneuvered, crushed every opposition movement he's faced. Of course, actually handing over to his son, who's younger and less tested, may well be a bigger challenge than dealing with the opposition up to now.
How will that work? How will Hun Sen ensure that his son Hun Manet succeeds him?
Well, it's interesting because the timetable now looks quite fast. He'd left it very vague, and of course at times Hun Sen has told Cambodians, I'll never give up. He flips around, but looks like he's going to do it within the first few weeks after the election. That suggests he's confident. Hun Manet has been groomed for this for a long time. He's Western educated, very different personality from his father, who of course had that incredible baptism of fire as a sort of former Khmer Rouge fighter. Very different generation, much smoother, much more presentable, but probably lacks the kind of ruthless instincts. And while opposition parties have been greatly weakened in Cambodia and often been very disunited themselves, there is a lot of factional fighting inside Mr. Hun Sen's own party. The oligarchs and the super-rich families who surround him are also ambitious, and it's them he'll have to watch. And what he's doing is all these core of ministers who are the same age as him, who came through the brutal years of the Civil War, are all aiming to retire at the same time, his interior minister, his defence minister, and they're all handing over to their sons as well. It's like a sort of mass dynastic handover. We're not entirely sure how it's going to work. We can be pretty sure that Hun Sen feels it's going to go smoothly, because otherwise he wouldn't be doing it.
Jonathan Head in Cambodia. It is 100 days since fighting broke out between Sudan's army and its paramilitary rival, the Rapid Support Forces, or RSF. The war has devastated the capital, Khartoum, displaced more than 3 million people and triggered a sharp increase in ethnic violence in the western region of Darfur. Numerous attempts to broker a ceasefire have failed, and there's no sign that either side is ready to negotiate peace. Barbara Platusha reports from Nairobi.
The humanitarian situation is getting more and more urgent as battle lines harden. Aid agencies have managed to position some supplies in the eastern part of the country, which is relatively stable, from where they are trying to send food and medicine to the conflict zones. But fighters continue to loot supplies and stop convoys at checkpoints. Analysts monitoring the war say the army has suffered significant setbacks in Khartoum and in other parts of the country. There are reports that it sent envoys back to Saudi Arabia to resume failed ceasefire talks, but there's been no evidence of progress. Outside Khartoum, the worst fighting is taking place in the western region of Darfur, with accounts of ethnically targeted attacks and killings blamed on the rapid support forces and allied militias. The RSF denies the charges, but the International Criminal Court has opened an investigation into suspected war crimes.
Barbara Platasha. Netflix has released its first original African animation series, Super Team 4. The 8-part series is set in a futuristic version of the Zambian capital, Lusaka, and tells the story of 4 female teenage superheroes on a mission to save their city.
Bunde, you're a superhero. I'm telling Boma and Bondate.
Tell me what you did. The series is the latest result of Netflix's strategy of investing in global talent. Malenga Mulundema is the director of Super Team 4, and she spoke to Audrey Brown from Zambia.
Super Team 4 is basically about 14 girls who are recruited by a former spy who happens to be a granny, and she recruits them to her secret superhero agency, and they get to save the world.
And she has a goat.
Yes, she has a goat.
And who are the supervillains?
Well, we have a ton of very interesting villains. I think that people just have to tune in to get to know. So,
oh, come on. Just episode, a little taster. What sorts of things are they doing to the world?
Oh, my goodness.
What are they threatening?
They're doing a lot of very wacky things, very interesting villainous stuff. Thinking about them right now, I'm laughing because they're quite funny and interesting. So there's one interesting one I think that people have seen in the trailer. They're calling him Croc Man. He is trying to steal some items in the marketplace so that he can have a picnic with his lady love that you soon find out who she is in the series.
Okay.
So the girls say to him, you don't have to steal her heart.
That's a great line. So why this particular story about superheroes and them being girls and the granny being the spy master? What's the connection that you'd like to create between your target audience and the story that you're telling?
I think I was just thinking about what I, as a child, would have enjoyed watching on TV. So I put from so many different elements of things that I watched on TV and also from just life in Lusaka, Zambia. So grannies, you know, particularly for a girl, for the whole community, but then for the girl, there's that sort of connection. You know, she's a source of wisdom, like an encyclopedia in the family. We love our grannies. And I thought about that relationship, basically, and then setting it in this kind of space where you make sort of the leader of this pack of girls.
And we all believe that our grannies have superpowers, right?
Exactly.
Would you say that animation is a strong medium in Africa? For instance, you know, the Japanese have a very powerful tradition of animation. I'm not sure that that's the case in various different African countries, is it?
I think it's an industry that's growing, and I think it's exciting to think about if, you know, there's more investment put into the industry, we're going to see very extraordinary things coming out of Africa.
And this is where Netflix comes in, right? It's investing in talent across the globe, and this project is one of, I imagine, many. What kinds of possibilities do you see Netflix bringing?
When I think about the stories that we can tell, I can begin from there. When you think about, for example, the anthology that has come out, like Kizazimoto, you know, that Sugarfish was a part of, you cannot really box what can come out of Africa.
What about style? Because animation has got such rich traditions across the world. What did you draw on?
Lusaka provided so much inspiration. I mean, it's incredible when you go back and look at what our artistic director and director, we look at the textures, the clothes, and some of the patterns. Like, for example, if you go into Mama K's underground HQ, in the center, there's a space I think we pull from Tonga baskets, reed baskets, and the patterns there. So there were a lot of things that they were taking and expanding on. And you could just see the vibrancy of Lusaka City, how they played around with patterns and colors.
Malenga Mulundema talking to Audrey Brown from Zambia. Now, it all began with a maths class in Australia, where violinists Brett Yang and Eddie Chen met. They formed a duo called Two Set Violin, specialising in mixing comedy with orchestral music. Their YouTube channel gained around 3 million subscribers. They're now on a world tour, and Iona Hampson met them in London.
Two Set Violin is one of the biggest classical music acts online, with millions of subscribers and over 1.3 billion views on their YouTube channel.
They are known for their entertaining and informative videos, ranging from mocking inaccurate depictions of violinists in film, creating fictional rap battles with famous composers like Bach. Complex polyphony, a sort of tonality. They call me the real OG, that's why y'all keep coming back to me. And even encouraging the biggest classical acts, such as Hilary Hahn, to take part in challenges, like playing Mozart on the violin while hula hooping. Before their London show, I met the duo.
Hi everyone, my name is Brett Yang.
And my name is Eddie Chen.
Who told me how their friendship began.
We met in a very typically Asian way, which was in maths tutoring after school on a Friday. The very next day, on a Saturday, we both had enrolled into our very first time at the youth orchestra.
You know, we were self-taught editing, filming, no experience at all. We're just playing violin musicians. And that's kind of where FUSA happened.
Despite venturing into the online world, they told me sticking to their roots is crucial to their identity.
You want to stay true to its essence, but at the same time, find ways to connect and meet people where they are. For example, Singapore Symphony or Hilary Hahn, they've all told us that their concerts have had a lot more people that were like, hey, I'm from Tuset and I discovered classical music and now I'm going to a concert for the first time.
Dr. Brian Kavanagh is a lecturer in digital innovation at King's College London. He has worked with organisations including the LA Philharmonic Orchestra and the English National Opera to help them adapt to the digital world.
One of the things that's really impressive about what Tuset Violin are doing is that they offer a very wide range of content. And I think orchestras and opera companies and string quartets, they can benefit from offering perhaps a wider range of content.
Over the past 10 years, their channel has grown significantly and allowed them to achieve their dreams of going on two world tours. At the London gig, I spoke to some of their fans to find out what the duo means to them.
My name is Maud. I live in Paris.
Why did you come all the way from Paris for the concert?
Because they weren't coming to Paris. They make fun videos, and since I play the violin, I like their videos.
Little by little, I was like, wait, I'm part of the community now, because I was getting the inside jokes, which is part of why I love to watch them.
While Eddie and Brett make Tuset, there is one fictional musician I have to mention. Ling Ling.
Ling Ling is a representation of that perfect model student that your mother always compares herself to.
Yeah.
So it's like, Ling Ling, practice 40 hours a day. Ling Ling got A+, what are you doing?
So much of the world, we see like a perfection. We see like a view of everything being the completed product and everyone doing well.
Yeah, especially with social media, we all notice everything looks so perfect. But I think it's the imperfections that makes us human.
It's not an excuse to not be better. You don't just go, oh, nobody's perfect, therefore I'm just going to not practice. But you realise at a certain point that the journey matters more than this destination.
That report by Iona Hampson. And that's all from us for now, but the Global News podcast will be back very soon. This edition was mixed by Philip Bull and produced by Emma Joseph. Our editor's Karen Martin. I'm Oliver Conway. Until next time, goodbye.